You know, keeping up with what's going on in the world can sometimes feel like it's more trouble than it's worth. The news can be scary and make you want to scream. Or there's just simply too much out there to keep up with. But that's why there's the Assorted Goods podcast. It's the amateur's guide to world events, where each episode we take a closer look at a collection of stories that slip through the cracks of the regular news cycle. So find Assorted Goods on whatever podcast app you use, and join me in my attempts to learn a little more about the world, one story at a time.
No questions?
Hocus pocus. Mumbo jumbo. Black magic.
Ricks, do you believe in evil?
As an idea.
Do you believe in the power of darkness?
As a superstition.
Now there you are wrong. The power of darkness is more than just a superstition. It is a living force which can be tapped at any given moment of the night.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater, as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review, rather it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with some background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of the film's plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. This week, we are continuing our month-long theme, Tall, Dark, and Gruesome. That's our selection of some fantastic Christopher Lee feature films. This week, we are diving into the Hammer horror classic, 1968's The Devil Rides Out. Join us! I don't know about you, but personally, I find British horror films to be so delightfully frustrating and marvelous at the same time. They're often just so prim and proper in how they want to present their subject matter. And then, when you sit down to watch them, they really have the potential, especially as the years rolled on, to go ahead and really take a turn for the sinister and the tawdry. And hey, sinister and tawdry, that's our bread and butter around these parts. Hammer horror films were always something that interest me. And what's more, many of them were movies that I would come across during many a Halloween marathon on AMC in my youth. Hammer films were a little bit different, sort of a strange side breed when compared to the Universal Monster films. They're in color, they pushed the envelope in what they would show for blood, as well as in exposed flesh, and at the same time, they were just so, well, British in their sensibilities. They would be loaded with wall-to-wall action and yet still have the ability to be considered both corny and boring by those who didn't have the ability to step back and properly see them in the larger context. Now, as a studio, Hammer was founded in 1934 by the comedic entertainer William Hines, and during the first few years of its existence, it focused mainly on making comedies. Makes kind of sense. And had varying levels of little to no success, which caused an early bankruptcy, and that forced the company to take stock and actually get liquidated to become part of a larger firm. They joined the distribution company, Exclusive Film. Now, during the war years, Exclusive Film kept the Hammer Studio itself on as sort of a production wing. was no longer called Hammer, but that didn't matter. It would crank out a number of films made on the cheap to help keep up with the demand, just so that content could be put out to British cinemas. And, you know, still operate by making small, little domestic pictures. All, again, in an effort to make way for when larger films were not available to be seen. Eventually, though, these little domestic films, they started to actually have decent box office returns in their own right. And Hammer, as an actual studio, was reborn again in the late 1940s, when exclusive films essentially set them up to be an in-house production company. But it put them under a new banner, called them Hammer Film Productions, with a bunch of new partners at the helm. Enrique and James Carreras, and both William Hines and now his son, Tony Hines, making the calls. That foursome spent the late 40s and the early 1950s making a number of crime and drama thrillers, which built up the studio's coffers and helped them get their financial house in order. Then, by the mid-1950s, they struck upon cinematic gold. You see, the British Board of Film Censors had gone on and created a new rating. They called it an X certificate, which I'm going to point out right now, far different than the American MPAA X counterpart. This acted more like the American R rating. It was made to designate films that were to be viewed by adults only, which in Britain would be ages 16 and up, again, similar to our R rating, 17 and up. And these were films that could show horror, violence, and have a macabre story. And Hammer decided to run with this and brand their first X film, adapting a story from the serialized BBC science fiction television series, The Quatermass Experiment. And they were going to bring it to the big screen as a motion picture. Now, as a movie, it's a lot of fun. You got a joint team of British and American astronauts who go to space, and they end up coming back missing a number of members, and the only survivor is this crazy feral mutating guy who's unable to comment on what exactly happened. Thus, it's up to the head scientist, Bernard Quatermass. Oh, damn it, I said Quatermass. It's Quatermass. I do that all the time. To get to the bottom of things, and of course, there's a battle against a growing alien menace who's come back to Earth. Seriously, go see it. It's a lot of fun. The most important part of all that was the film was a hit. And this led to Hammer diving into what would become their golden years, where they cranked out horror films pell-mell. They went on to release a bunch of great stuff. They had X the Unknown in 1956. They had Quatermass 2, which was Quatermass in the Pit for us stateside. That came out in 57. That's another really fun one. And of course, they released, again, in 1957, The Curse of Frankenstein, which we discussed last week is how a young Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing got together as friends. But as the following decade rolled on, Hammer continued to crank out all of those various incarnations of the classic and gothic horror stylings. Here's the problem, though. The times were a-changing, and audiences were clamoring for more gruesome tales that were, oh, you know, a little more in line with modern times. And then somebody got the bright idea to go on and say, hey, why don't we use some of this best-selling horror novels that we have just out and about today, and we'll make a film out of them. Thus you have author Dennis Wheatley being tapped to start having his stories made into films. You don't know Wheatley? Well, he was the Stephen King of Britain in like the 1940s, whose work at the time in the 60s was having a huge resurgence. Still not familiar? Oh. Okay, well, here. Put on a pot of coffee. We're gonna get into this.
Who could it be? Who could it be? I just can't imagine. Who could it be?
Dennis Yates Wheatley was born January 8, 1897. Originally, he was from a family of vintners, but he himself decided to make a career switch in the late 1930s and become an author, right around the time that his wine business was not working out. He subsequently, though, made a name for himself in the 40s with his thrillers, and by the time that this film was ready to be made in the 1960s, he was himself a cottage industry. Having written several best-selling series, dabbling in spy novels, science fiction, fantasy, adventure stories, and horror. Not to mention the fact that the man had created several boxed board games. Quite conservative in his views, which in a modern sense makes reading his works really complicated. If one is looking for enjoyable stories that don't fetishistically support British imperialism, strong class distinctions, and goes out of its way to tie liberalism of thought and action to being the results of evil. Which, of course, leads people to only one simple conclusion. Of course. Old Scratch himself is going to be behind the push for ridiculously dangerous things like equality, social reform, and, God help us, letting people of color rule over themselves without proper help from white Christian Anglos. Now, it's a really important distinction. For the day, Wheatley himself did not consider himself to be racist. He, in his writing and in his personal letters, believed that bigots were equally people that needed to be stopped. But his own high regard of the British monarchy, as well as his views on imperialism, made him rather myopic to the notion that by telling folks that their culture was inferior is still racist. Look, I would call him a man of his time, but in my opinion, personally, Wheatley was an asshole even for the day. But that said, he was a creative one, and he wrote some really interesting stories, and he created some really memorable characters, including the main one at the center of this week's film, Jean-Armand Duplessis, who was the Duke de Richelieu. Over the course of 30 years and 11 novels, the Duke served as one of Wheatley's consummate examples of a heroic man derived from, air quotes, good breeding. Indeed, as a character, de Richelieu was born the son of a French aristocrat, who, by the way, of course, hated the French Republic, Wheatley, and a Russian princess. And he spent his life getting a bunch of fine schooling, traveling, residing on vast estates held by his family. He, of course, was a soldier of fortune in his youth, and that led him to traveling the world and mastering a number of languages and learning all about the magical arts. He himself, of course, practiced good, air quotes, white magic. And he was part of an order to combat the darkness. Now, of course, he also took his inheritance money and, quote, invested it wisely, so that in his middle age he was vastly wealthy and could live the life of a playboy and leisure. Oh, by the way, in his youth he also participated in a failed plot to reestablish the French monarchy. And was basically forced to live in exile the rest of his life in both Britain and abroad, which is perfect for setting him up to be a, quote, spy and fixer for various other governments like Spain, Britain, and Russia to battle evil practitioners of the dark arts along the way. So, honestly, it's a really good character to adapt to the big screen. Oh, sorry, I would be shirking my duties if I didn't throw this in as well. Since the character would go on to battle the occult, Wheatley spent a lot of time writing and reading on the occult itself. So much so that later in life he published his own, and I'm, again, sorry I'm doing this a lot, using historical air quotes as a reference book. He printed it in 1971, and he called it The Devil and All His Works. How to be kind here. I have a copy of this book sitting on my shelf. It's actually 3 feet to my left. I'm sure that when it was published that this was considered really heady stuff, really pushing the envelope, pulling back that veil and revealing to all of us some really dark truths. In reality, there really isn't much of, quote, the devil in this book. Rather, Wheatley seems to be the inspiration for a number of those cheesy but oh-so-awesome Time Life books that were put out in the late 70s and the early 80s on a number of weird subjects. You know, they'd be like, Time Life presents aliens, magic, cryptids, that sort of stuff. where they would pack it in with psychics, palm reading, numerology, voodoo, and essentially short blurbs about non-Christian religions, all laid out in a really stuffy and a very indignant fashion that makes Wheatley's book just sort of bypass anyone interested in actual scholarship on either the occult or on world religions. Which means if you're looking to get real information, you should skip it. Now, as a coffee table book or a conversation starter, it's a fantastically fun thing to page through. The artwork's gorgeous, there's all kinds of photos, and there's some honestly laugh-out-loud passages from a man who takes himself way too seriously. That being said, though, because he wrote this book and would write such stories featuring the occult, a lot of folks tend to give Wheatley a lot of reverence as being an expert on such matters, which I have to say, again, at least in my own humble opinion, as someone who's studied just about other religions in general, he is totally not an expert. He's just a guy that had some opinions and then wrote a really half-baked, half-researched book, and at the same time, it's still a lot of fun to look at. So just keep that in your back pocket. For his part, Christopher Lee was very pleased with the decision that Hammer Films was opting to adapt one of Wheatley's novels. He had honestly wanted Hammer to make some more films about the supernatural for a number of years, albeit taking the more extraordinary path. He was leaning towards the writing of either Wheatley or Ray Bradbury or Arthur C. Clarke, but since occult films were going through some sort of a renaissance at the time, this was a way to get into that kind of storytelling. A horror film that didn't have to include, quote, a silly monster, or at least buckets of technicolor gore. Hammer was starting to draw at the end of what would be considered their golden age, where they just kept pumping out all these rehashes of tired, but still faithful classic monsters, and they were still seeing profit at the box office. Here's the problem, though. When that's the only thing that's available to the box office, people will pay for it. But when you start offering other options, quickly, nobody wants to see your rewarmed over crap. Lee was astute enough to see that he was tired of playing these roles, and he was pointing out himself, look, the public had reached their saturation point. And while Hammer at the time had half-heartedly attempted to branch out with some different, but unfortunately still gothically inspired offering, they had made things like The Gorgon in 1964, or they had done Rasputin the Mad Monk in 1966. That's a fun one. They were still leery of changing course and getting away from their bread and butter of monsters. Now, this would actually be the second Dennis Wheatley outing that Hammer would produce. They had already filmed his prehistoric adventure film, The Lost Continent, when they were getting ready to make this one. Truth be told, Hammer had been quietly seeking the rights and had wanted to make this as a film, a full 4 years earlier, back in 1963. But they were waiting on changes from both the censorship board, as well as lobbying not only from Lee, but from production manager Tony Keyes to get studio head Tony Hines to fully embrace the making of this film. See, Hines himself found Wheatley's books to be dull. But to his credit, he was at least smart enough to know that if all these people are telling me this could be big, I'll at least give them a listen. Production itself would launch in August of 1967, and it would last through the end of September that year, working with a budget of £285,000 sterling, which, when put into modern money and in modern American dollars, that would come out to being $5.9 million in U.S. currency. They got director Terence Fisher, who had previously shot The Curse of Frankenstein in 57, Dracula in 58, as well as The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Mummy, both in 1959, and all of those with Christopher Lee. Once he was on board, they decided that they were going to play Wheatley's novel straight, leaning hard into the fact that the story at its base was being told as if it was a warning to alert people to the inherent dangers of such dark practices. And that, in doing so, and not really getting into the real, quote, details of the rites that devil worship was supposed to have as described in the novel, Hammer could try to have things both ways. They're both using this well-known story, but at the same time, they're not showing anything objectionable that would draw censorship ire. Sticking with setting the story in the late 1920s, Hammer began to assemble its talent. Lee, of course, was cast in the lead role of the Duc de Richelieu, here renamed Nicholas to make it a little easier and less foreign. Charles Grey, who we've discussed before when we covered Theater of Blood, was another man who would go on to play a Bond villain himself. He was cast here as the villainous but mysterious Mr. Makata. Nikki Arrighi was cast as the beautiful Tanith Carlyle. Leon Green, who at the time was an opera singer, was cast to play the Duke's right-hand man, Rex von Rhein, and Patrick Moore was cast to be their young charge, Simon, a man who finds himself entangled by Makata's satanic cult. Throw in Sarah Lawson, Paul Eddington, and Rosalind Landor to play the Eaton family, and you have a fairly solid cast here of actors. Now, an initial draft of the script was put out first by writer John Hunter. But, well, for lack of a better descriptor here, it was honestly considered to be too British by the British people making it. And so it was reworked and repolished by a little guy named Richard Matheson. Please, do yourself a favor, go back, see our episode on The Last Man on Earth. Richard Matheson is awesome. Matheson attempted to liven up what seemed to be a rather tepid horror offering by inserting a few extra scenes, most notably the giant spider scene, into the mix to offer viewers something to react to. We'll get into that a little later. It was also here, though, that Matheson was able to condense some very broad themes of Wheatley's novel down to their essence, and by jettisoning the subplot, where in the novel the Satanists are attempting to kick off World War II, and focus instead on a group of old friends trying to aid a wayward member, Matheson was able to tell a really succinct tale, one that author Dennis Wheatley actually heartily approved of. Unlike previous Hammer offerings, where special effects were avoided to save on budget, when it came to filming The Devil Rides Out, the effects were purposely limited to help try to ground the story and make what was seemingly unrealistic feel more nightmarish in its seemingly ordinariness. Hence, instead of having flashy monsters, you get uncredited horror roles going to actors. Actors like Yemni Ajibade, who is the corporal form of a summoned demon who comes in the guise of a red-eyed, grinning African man. Or you have stuntman Eddie Powell, uncredited here again, portraying the physical manifestation of the devil himself, showing up in the guise of the Goat of Mendes. Lee himself was acquainted with the work of Dennis Wheatley. He was a fan, and he took it upon himself to go and do a little research for the role as well. Reading up on the occult, even going so far as to go to the British Museum, just like his character did, to, quote, learn the history of what, I stress, at the time, was considered to be factual knowledge about devil worshippers and black magic. And in later years, he would claim that the ritual language that he chants at the end of this film, that was a bona fide actual Samusama ritual that he found in a book on dark magic, a prayer to actually help one with exorcism. Look, I don't really think I have the energy to get into this now, so let me just sum this up. Wheatley made the damn ritual up. He actually cribbed it from another author of the day because he liked it and he used it in his own novel. But suffice to say, I'm not going to call Christopher Lee a liar. What I'm going to say is he did a little skewed homework on the occult because he wanted the project to be a good one. And if he felt that he was saying stuff that would be authentic and that led to him having a better performance, who am I to question it? He is great here. Besides, this was Lee's big chance to play a heroic role. He wasn't doing any more of those bad guy villains, and he had been wanting this chance for so long, he didn't want to screw it up. He wanted to do a good job, so I understand completely. Now, there were issues on this set, just like any other production. In his memoirs, second unit technical director Christopher Neame recounts a large number of troubles they had on set in the country when they were doing the car chase scenes. While they were trying to get those crazy, crazy maneuvers on those country dirt roads, they ended up sending the stunt car that had the camera strapped to it into a ditch, burst a tire, bashed in the front. Worse, as it rolled into the ditch, it smashed the camera. Now, they ended up getting the shots, and the film itself was fine, but both the car they were using and the camera were out of commission for that portion of filming, and that essentially shut down the second unit crew for the remainder of the week. Small things would also happen on set, such as the wings would continually fall off the horse that served to be the Angel of Death's mount. For his part, director Fisher himself was not really pleased with the story he was telling. He felt that there should be more of, well, honestly, everything. More horror, more action, literal and figurative skin in the game. And he was also lamenting the fact that this tacked-on B story that was between Green's and Aragi's character, it was so underdeveloped and rather awkward. It's not like it is in the novel. They actually have a true character romance that builds. Here, it's just one day, they're enemies, the next day, she loves him. That, and in watching the dailies, the director was becoming less and less enthused about the performance that actor Leon Green was giving. Now again, to his credit, Green was an onstage performer. He had done musical theater, he had done opera, but this was his first film role, and it was still new to him. Try as he might, the man did not stick his lines or properly emote as director Fisher would have wanted him to. And by the end of production, all of his lines and audio would end up being redubbed and re-recorded by veteran actor Patrick Allen. That had to be a slap in the face. Hammer, for their part, had partnered with 20th Century Fox Films for distribution in the United States, and the film was given a new title as executives were convinced that Americans would be, well, frankly, too dumb to know that a picture with the title, The Devil Rides Out, was not a Western. Seriously. Branded instead, The Devil's Bride, which doesn't make a lick of sense in the context of this story, the film was ready to go. In his personal notes on the film's name change, Lee makes mention that the film was renamed by the Americans and gets into the whys, and then drolly puts underneath, "I have no comment." The film was set to make its debut in the United Kingdom in July of 1968, before it would show up across the pond in December of that same year. But folks, you have been ever so patient here listening to me prattle on. How's about I stop my yapping and we take a look at that trailer? What do you say?
Believe in the power of darkness.
That's a superstition.
Now there you are wrong. The power of darkness is more than just a superstition. It is a living force which can be tapped at any given moment of the night.
Why, on one night of one year, should these people live in mortal fear? Who knows he must fight the devil's power to the death.
My God.
Don't look at the eyes, Rex!
Eyes, once filled with love, are consumed with fear. For Tanith is now promised to the devil.
Listen carefully to what I say.
This is Makata, the devil's chief disciple.
Your will is leaving you. It's
slipping away. The Devil Rides Out, from bestseller author Dennis Wheatley's famous novel, fills the screen with a special kind of visual terror.
On your feet, quickly! Back to back, join hands!
You will hear his evil. You will feel his evil. You will see his evil.
If we once catch sight of his face.
We open in an airfield where two old friends, Nicholas, the Duke de Reichlieu, as played by Christopher Lee, and Rex Van Ryn, as played by Leon Green, are getting together to meet with their much younger companion, Simon Aaron, as played by Patrick Mower. The two older men have a rather avuncular relationship with Simon. They've been looking in on him and helping mold him after he lost his father years prior. And this reunion was supposed to be some sort of a happy reminiscing. They're upset to find that in spite of having made plans to get together months ago, instead of being ready to receive them, Simon is nervous and has a house full of strange pushy people who have seemingly taken over the place. It's an astrological society, as he calls it, and they're led by an intense and mysterious man named Mr. Makata, who's played by Charles Gray, who instructs Simon to give his friends the bum's rush, lest they be interrupted with their secret meeting. For his part, the Duke picks up very quickly that something is gravely amiss, and before he can be thrown out, he voluntarily offers to leave, right after, of course, he gets a peek at Simon's palatial home's observatory. When he enters and finds a pentagram drawn on the floor, a tiled face of the deity Baphomet in the middle of it, and a bunch of chickens in the closet ready for sacrifice, he turns on his young friend and accuses him of wantonly flirting with the dark arts.
You fool!
I'd rather see you dead than meddling with black magic.
Let go of me.
I didn't ask you to come here tonight. Even my oldest friends have no right to butt in on my private affairs.
Will someone please say...
I'm sorry, Simon. But I feel like a father who sees his child trying to pick live coals out of a fire.
Will someone kindly tell me what's going on? Chickens in a basket, diagrams on a floor. Do these mean something to you?
It means that Simon here is playing the most dangerous game known to mankind.
Oh, come on, Nicholas.
Well, Rex is right. You're making too much of it.
Then you've no objection if we stay.
You aren't members of the Circle.
Circle?
Society.
If we stayed, there'd be more than 13, wouldn't there? Look, Simon, I think you will admit that whilst Rex and I have been your closest friends for more than 10 years now, we have never at any time stressed our age or our greater experience. Now, tonight, I'm going to break that rule. I'm considerably older than you are, Simon. And although I've never spoken about it, I've made a very deep study of these esoteric doctrines. I beg of you, as I've never begged anything in my life before, give up this desperately dangerous adventure and leave this house with us immediately.
I can't.
Then let us stay.
Impossible.
Knowing that this is a satanic cult, and that they've brainwashed their friend, Rex and Duke knock the young Simon out and kidnap him from his home, much to the distress of Makata and the other cult members. The Duke then puts the young man to sleep and places a crucifix around his throat for protection. And then he stays up, explaining to Rex the realities and very real dangers of such occult activity. Simon has the crucifix removed by butler Max, as played by Keith Pyatt, who notices that it was strangling the young man, and as soon as it's removed, Simon runs off with the aid of the cult into the night. The pair end up returning to Simon's home and find everyone has gone, but they're instead confronted by a demonic apparition, as played by Yemni Agdabadi, in the observatory where they come searching. and he begins to work his evils on Rex before the Duke can stop him with his Latin chanting of prayer and his crucifix. They determine that they need to find Simon and save him from his upcoming planned unholy baptism into the cult. And the key to finding him is going to be to find the other young initiate that they had met at the so-called party the night before. A young woman named Tanith is played by Nikki Arrighi. So they can determine where the cult will actually meet next. The Duke ends up tracking her down and sends Rex to go out and collect her, while he goes to the British Museum to brush up on his knowledge of the occult in order to fight it. They agree to meet back at the home of their family friends, the Eatons, the next day. Rex goes and picks up Tanith from her hotel, and she goes with him as a complete stranger because, you know, why not? Until she realizes that he intends to stop her and Simon from being given over to the cult. It's in that moment that she hears Mikada's voice in her head, threatening her if she doesn't come back to him. As soon as they arrive at the Eaton estate, Tanith steals Rex's car and leads him on a country road chase, one that ends with dark powers causing fog to obscure the man's view, and almost gets himself killed in a wreck that lands him in a ditch. Rex does survive this encounter, though, and walks further up the road to a country estate, where he finds that Simon, Mikada, and Tanith, as well as the rest of the cult, are preparing to travel out to the Salisbury Plains to hold their mystic rites. Rex stows himself away in the trunk of a cult member's car, and once he arrives at the site, he finds a phone booth on the road and alerts the Duke on where to meet him. The two men rendezvous and watch as Mikada leads the group in a strange ceremony that involves the killing of a sacrificial goat and then the collecting and drinking of its blood, all while dancing wildly to some intense bongos. At the height of a frenzy, Mikada calls forth Baphomet to appear, and then the devil himself shows up, to both Duke and Rex's collective shock.
We must get them out of here. Then, Tanith too. Tanith is her real name. This is her baptism as well.
Very well, we'll do what we can.
The two men use one of the cars to run down cult members and disrupt the ceremony, hurling a crucifix at the devil and making him disappear in a puff of brimstone, before then engaging in fisticuffs with several cult members, including Mikada, and grabbing both Simon and Tanith before hightailing out of there and back to the Eaton's place. Upon arriving, we get to meet the Eatons properly. Marie is played by Sarah Lawson, Richard is played by Paul Eddington, and their young daughter Peggy, played by Rosalind Landor. Marie is the Duke's niece, and she takes her uncle's story in without flinching, but Richard is understandably a bit confused and skeptical of this man walking in with tales of dark cult members coming their way. The Duke sends everybody to bed and then tells them he will be departing to get supplies, and warns them not to let cult members in. Thus, family members now find themselves drafted into a fight against the forces of darkness. As soon as the Duke leaves, Mikada comes calling to the house and worms his way inside to have a sit-down audience with Marie, attempting first to influence her into just giving him Simon and Tanith with his charm. And when she won't and blocks his attempts, He begins to use his mental powers to bend her to his will, all while simultaneously controlling Tanith and Simon to attack other members of the house. His influence and connection to them is interrupted by Peggy entering the room, and Mikata is kicked out of the house unceremoniously, but not before threatening the family.
Get out of this house, do you hear me?
I want the girl and Simon.
Show him out.
I'm leaving. I shall not be back, but something will. Tonight, something will come for Simon and the girl.
The Duke returns and sets the house up for a dark magic siege. He creates a large circle and surrounds it with protective runes on the floor in chalk. He brings in water, candles, crucifixes, and salt. Rex and Tanith leave the house to help keep the others safe from Mikata, while Peggy and her loyal butler, Malin, as played by Russell Waters, are locked upstairs in a bedroom away from the fray. The Eatons, the Duke, and Simon remain for the rest of the night in the center of the circle, fending off dark apparitions and threats that Mikata sends to them, which include hallucinations, a gigantic spider, and in the end, the Angel of Death itself, come to claim a soul. The Duke is able to rebuff the advances with his knowledge of the occult, but they discover in the morning that Death has taken Tanith in the night. You see, once summoned, the soul must be claimed. They leave the circle to discover that Mikata has kidnapped young Peggy, and they now need to find her location. The Duke is able to communicate with the spirit of the recently deceased Tanith, who is brought back to the house by Rex. And now in death, she is free from Makata's influence and can lead them to him. The group takes off and has a final confrontation with the cult back at their country estate. And while they are unsuccessful in stopping Makata's forces, when the leader himself goes to sacrifice young Peggy to the devil, the spirit of Tanith appears again and takes control of Marie's physical form, summoning the Angel of Death one more time, but now sending him after Mikata. The cult flees, the building burns, and all parties awake to the morning. They're back at the Eatons. They're all alive and well. Time has been reversed, and since the angel has taken Mikata, Tanith has been restored to life, divine judgment having been executed to correct the wrongs of the dark arts. The Duke thanks God, and the family and friends all embrace as credits roll. Man, where do we even begin? Well, here, let's start with what actually works. Lee is understandably fantastic here, playing the role of the hero. He didn't get to do it often in his career, so it's really nice to see him as this competent and avuncular character in The Duke. He's intense, yes, he's stern, but it's all in the context of desperately wanting to save his friends and family who have inadvertently stumbled into some sort of evil that they can't comprehend. If we were remaking the film today, it would come off perhaps as being sort of pompous and arrogant, but Lee really knows how to walk that line of being authoritative without coming across like an ass. He knows what's going on, he's identified it, and it's both dangerous and needs to be taken seriously. The only downside is, at least with his character, is he never seems to have time to explain what his own plan is and what he's going to do next, so he keeps leaving these people he loves to go off to prepare things, and then when he comes back and finds out that they've been, you know, attacked, got lost, someone ran away, he's always frustrated when these bad things have happened in his absence, but he's never given them proper warning. Now, for his part, actor Charles Gray as Mikata is equally superb. He's so quiet, but so intense, and there's this truly chilling air about him, especially when he's having his false pleasantries exchanged with Marie at the house. His good cheer melts away in the face of a woman that will not give in to his flattery and charm. And what you're left with is his intense blue eyes staring down as he tries to wrest control of basically her entire being from Maria and have her give up Simon and Tanith to him. It's honestly one of the best scenes in the film, and in reality, it's just a conversation between two people.
I know the Duke de Richelieu has been filling your mind with all sorts of preposterous nonsense about me.
I know that what he said is true.
You realize that Tanith and Simon may be in considerable danger if they do not leave this house.
On the contrary, they would be safe nowhere else.
Mrs. Eaton, it's obvious that you distrust me, and after what your friends have told you about me, I'm not surprised in the least. However, your obvious intelligence emboldens me to think that I will serve my purpose best by putting my cards on the table, as it were.
There's no more to be said.
Please, hear me out. Dear lady, I do not propose to discuss with you the rights and wrongs of practicing the magic art. I will confine myself to saying that I am a practitioner of some experience. Monsieur de Richelieu has no doubt led you to believe that I am thoroughly even. Such is not the case. In magic, there is neither good nor evil. It is merely a science. The science of causing change to occur by means of one's will. The sinister reputation attaching to it is entirely groundless and is based on superstition rather than objective observation. The power of the will is something people do not understand, attributing to it mysterious qualities which it does not possess, being merely the power of mind over matter, or in the greater number of cases, the power of mind over mind, as your mind now is succumbing to mine. For as you look into my eyes and listen to my voice, your will is leaving you, slipping away, and you are now beneath my influence.
I think it's interesting to note that unlike some of the other Hammer beauties of the day, Origi's Tanith as a character is rather complex, different from just the stock trope of being the woman in peril, you know, just somebody's fiance or young wife that's being menaced by a monster. Don't get me wrong, she's still the love interest, she still does face some peril, but what makes her different is she's fairly game, at least at first, to go along with the whole let's get baptized with the goat's blood and join the rest of the cult. It's only when she's in the thick of it that she starts to have a change of heart, partly seeing all of the crazy going on, but ultimately gazing upon the manifestation of evil itself is what changes her mind. That, and also for reasons we really can't explain here, she and Rex fall madly in love, after, of course, she's stolen his car and left him for dead in a ditch. In addition, where action is often just a bunch of men emoting through conversations with one another in a film like this, it's interesting that part of the plot device is all the power that Makata is leveling against our heroes is coming from Tanith herself. She's the medium that the cult is using, the catalyst. So, as a woman, she's essential and central to this story, which again, for the time, is rather unique when it comes to making films. Alright, let's get into it. What doesn't work? Well, actually, a lot. Especially for modern viewers of this film. I know, when people look back on films that were made decades ago, storytelling, social mores, and permissive actions have all evolved over time, so our modern eyes need to be able to take in that story from the context of when it was filmed. I get it. You want to be woke, but you at least have to know what's going on. The Devil Rides Out is a masterclass in filmmaking. Technically, it's really nicely done. It looks gorgeous, the actors are wonderful, the story does have some crackling moments of intense fun. But at the end of the day, the horror, at least horror as intended, is just not there. Unless you're so wildly religious that just mentioning the devil or seeing a really kind of half-done manifestation of him standing around on a rock watching some people dance from a distance is something that you find really scary. Film is a visual medium, so logically, showing horror is what one would expect to see when you go to see a horror film. Now, I'm not going to say this needs to be extreme. I'm not going to tell you that you needed to see the cult members eating some newborns or joining together in some kind of unholy orgy. I mean, let's be honest, I'll tell you, yeah, I think that would have been a nice touch, but you don't need it. But you at least have to give us something a little more extreme than pasty white folks dancing around holding cups of what is supposed to be goat's blood that looks very reminiscent to grape juice. Or, in this case, I get it, you don't want to offend the censors. Don't show me, tell me about it. Talk about the potentially horrible things that the cult are doing off-screen. Because then, in reality, it becomes all even more horrific in the minds of the viewer. Imagination does not have boundaries or censors to rein the story in for them. That again would be something. What we get instead that is more disturbing as a modern watch? Well, the fact that that summoned demonic manifestation that first plagues the Duke and Rex back in the observatory, that is a grinning, red-eyed black man. And I will be clear, I am not saying that the monstrous form is a dark, shapeless, black figure. No, I unfortunately mean it is literally a man of African descent. Now, I will hand it to them. At least in the frame shot, having a leering, grinning man is quite disquieting, no matter who they are or who their race would be. But the fact that they use a foreign man, I'm using foreign man in air quotes here, as something of an exotic thing to be feared, even for a story that's set in the 1920s and early 30s, that seems to be rather dated. And it seems to be still wrong for a film that was made in 1968. And it's just another reason as to how this film is more frightening with its worldview rather than maintaining its classical scares by way of horror. Now, when this film was made, Lee himself acknowledged that people were initially concerned about the views of the church and how it would take umbrage with the film, potentially, as well as how the subject matter could lead to harsh censorship pushback, given both the time period and the stodginess of the British film censors when it came to depicting such perceived sacrilegious events like a black mass, or even just talking about black magic over and over again. But even for the day when you watch this movie, it's rather toothless. Thus, this actually makes it a really hard film to show people right out of the gate. Could you show it to younger kids? Actually, I would say yeah, you could. They won't know this is a horror movie, and they won't care. Can you show it to teenagers? You could. It would bore them to tears. They'd ask where the action was, they'd ask where the violence was, especially in a film that touts itself as being horrifying. And based on my previous statements, a bunch of these woke teens are going to be put off by all this casual racism that comes from Wheatley's story and that was put on screen by Hammer. So, you're not helping them. That leaves only adults to recommend this film to, and they have to be adults of a certain age, of a certain frame of mind, who have a reverence for a different period of filmmaking, and ones who can appreciate good acting and the story itself. That's not going to be a ton of people anymore. So, damn, Hammer, in your efforts to appeal to everybody, you ended up making a film that's very niche now and very cult that's going to appeal to a few. I'll also weigh in. I think that actor Leon Green was quite unfairly treated by this whole process. You can find some of his original audio that was not dubbed by Alan in the film's trailer. And honestly, to my ear, it's rather hard to hear a difference between the vocal performances that are given by the two actors. One, I guess, could chalk this up to the feature being so micromanaged by both Fisher and by Hammer Studios in an effort to make it successful that he was just a victim of circumstance. But you know, these are just things that I feel about the film. And not everyone has that same opinion that I do. And that's all right, because that's exactly why we have such things as the sidecar. And joining us today in the sidecar, after a worldwide tour spent solving mysteries and exposing magicians, we're honored to have a visit from the marvelous Dan Felton, that ever so genial and knowledgeable host of one of my favorite podcasts out there, the Assorted Goods Podcast. It's been a little while since we've heard from Dan, and he was nice enough to give this film a spin and share some of his thoughts on the picture itself. So, without further ado, please take it away, Dan.
Hey Chris, thanks for having me back again. So, okay, based on the book by Dennis Wheatley, who was apparently a bit of a Stephen King of his time, this 1968 adaptation is centered around a pair of friends looking to save a third friend from his induction into a satanic cult. Christopher Lee plays the lead, with a perfectly hoity-toity sounding name of Duke de Richelieu. Now that's a title I can get behind. He's a wealthy man of status, and apparently a pretty capable wizard of sorts.
Gandalf the White. Gandalf the Fool.
No. Not that wizard. Although, admittedly, like many people my age, my familiarity with Christopher Lee probably begins with his damn near perfect performance in The Lord of the Rings. This film is all about the occult. Demons, spirits, summonings, rituals, you know, all that good stuff. As a side note, Christopher Lee was apparently very fascinated by the occult himself, and there were even rumors that he owned countless books on the topic, although he never actually admitted to that fact. And when asked about the dark arts once, he stated that he knew many people who claimed to be Satanists, and warned that nobody should ever dabble in these things because, quote, you will not only lose your mind, but also your soul. Ooh. And it's a damn near perfect setup for the film we're talking about here. So The Devil Rides Out is a pretty typical tale of binary morality. Good versus evil, light versus dark, God versus the devil, black magic versus normal miracle magic or something. Now, I try to take a look at a film like this through the lens of the time it was made. And remember, we're talking about a film that is now 53 years old. The concept of the endless spiritual war of the powers of up high and the ones down below is pretty much a tale as old as time, and is probably more than enough to jumpstart a spiritual horror script in the late 1960s, a time where portions of society were still often freaked out by that devilish rock and roll music. For me, though, I honestly wasn't all that enthralled with the movie. I watched it, at times, almost half-heartedly, whether that's the simplicity of the storyline or maybe the fact that my fascination with all things occult is just at, well, about minimal levels. Except for the occasional laugh I have at the Reddit occult pages on one of my podcasts. But shh, don't tell them that. Anyways, the premise is straightforward. The Duke de Richelieu and his buddy Rex are looking to meet their friend Simon, who's a little tied up with the whole committing his soul to the devil thing he has going on. The Duke recognizes evil at play and quickly moves to try to save his friend. But the powers that Simon and another devil worshipper-to-be, the character Tanith, have submitted to are not so easily shaken. What unfolds is essentially a suspenseful cat-and-mouse game of the forces of evil looking to claim the souls of Simon and Tanith, while Rex and the Duke fight to keep evil at bay by any means necessary. Charles Gray, who plays the thoroughly evil Mokata, a good devil worshipper name in my opinion, but this guy's perfectly cast, with a piercing look that embodies the mind-controlling characteristics of the role of Mokata. Frankly, Charles Gray and Christopher Lee both nailing their roles is what makes The Devil Rides Out a film worth popping on for a quick 90-minute-ish tale of suspenseful horror. How the story unfolds bewildered me, though, a bit at times. Especially the character Rex, the friend of the Duke who aims to help his buddy Simon and then falls wistfully head over heels for Tanith, a woman he just met, and who tries to kill him on numerous occasions. Whatever floats your boat, I suppose. Most of the calamities in the story are centered around Rex attempting to help and then messing things up. First, he stares into a demon's eyes despite the Duke telling him repeatedly not to do that. And then, after trying to escort Tanith, who at one point tries to jump out of a moving car, He then leaves her in the car after they arrive at their destination, which she quickly steals and drives off. Rex pursues. The devil intervenes. Rex crashes. Later in the film, Rex falls asleep while he's supposed to be watching Tanith, and she almost stabs him in the heart. Then he takes Tanith to a safe place. And then, in a classic dopey 1960s man looking for woman style, he stares directly into her eyes as she becomes possessed, which results in him submitting to her will, or more so the will of Mokata via Tanith, if you follow. And as a result, Rex lets Tanith go free. My point being, the man does not think, at least with his brain. The film really only moves along because of Rex's bumbles, which the Duke then has to swoop in and clean up over and over with his own borderline divine powers of the occult. This may be where the plot was a little lost for me while watching. I couldn't get over Rex just messing things up over and over, even if I actually did also find him to be a likable character. Now, the part of The Devil Rides Out that I was really entertained by was the 1960s graphics to make the more supernatural scenes come to life, if you want to say that. The scene of the Duke, Simon, Mr. and Mrs. Eaton all sitting in their circle was maybe the high point of the film. The giant tarantula scene gets my skin crawling because, I mean, ew, but also the camera shots that were used to make the giant tarantula scene work were at times confusing, but also, as a result, entertaining to me. Half of that whole moment there, there's this rough shot CGI effect of a giant spider crawling around the room. And then spliced in at the same time are these shots that are clearly close-ups of an actual tarantula at floor level. And whoever put these shots together must have glossed over the fact that the live-action spider looks like a small, normal spider on the floor, and then poof, it's suddenly a giant tarantula, and then poof, suddenly it's back to being a normal-sized spider on the floor. It's the magic of cinema for you. And then, of course, the giant tarantula does end up eating the hallucinated version of the Eaton's daughter, Peggy. As for the kid, where the hell was she when Mom and Dad were surviving the night-long onslaught of demonic terrors? Tucked into bed nicely? Night-night, sweetie. If you hear a bump in the night, that's just the angel of death coming to claim our friends. Sleep tight. All right, look. I enjoyed watching the film, even if I wasn't crazy about it. That may be mainly because I liked watching a young Christopher Lee do his work. And believe me, he is the highlight of the film. The story is pretty simplistic. And despite being a relatively quick movie to watch, it still felt like the plot was strung out to me. Man saves friend from sacrifice to the devil. Devil takes it personally. Seems like there could have been more to it, but I don't know, what do I know? I've written a total of zero screenplays to date. But hey, anything's possible. Look, overall, The Devil Rides Out is entertaining in its own ways. You get some solid performances, you get some somewhat likable characters, and a plot that is at times thin, but it does work as a suspenseful thriller of who will live and who will die. If you're into the ideas of black magic and the occult, then this might especially be for you. Although, heed Christopher Lee's warnings and be careful not to lose your soul. Right. Well, again, that's my review of the film. I want to give a big thanks to Chris for having me on once more and giving me the chance to watch a classic film, something I don't do nearly enough. If you want more entertaining content for your curious mind, then pop over to my podcast, Assorted Goods, where I dive into a variety of topics, big and small, to try to learn just a little bit more about the world. Results may vary. Thanks to you as the listener as well. I hope you enjoyed. Hope you'll consider giving a listen to my podcast and that you come back again and again for I Saw It on Linden Street. All the best, folks. Take care of yourselves out there.
I have to say, Dan doesn't say anything here that I don't really agree with, and he actually nails the response that seems to resonate with most viewers this side of the pond. They don't hate it, but they're waiting for it to get better. I'll go on and both agree and affirm Rex, as a character, is kind of a buffoon. It's his hapless bad ideas. They just seem to be used as a way to transition the story from point A to point B and keep things moving along. As for the giant spider scene, I will say it is a point of contention for so many. Now, Dan's a little younger than me, so I'll spare him the old man Chris take, but this isn't actually CGI due to it being 1968. It's rather a layered traveling mat shot that's used to create the illusion that this spider is truly massive. As a scene, it's silly, not because of what it's trying to do, but more in the sense, as Dan points out, The sizing and the angles change so much, it makes the spider seem wildly inconsistent, and thus a scene that could be scary comes off looking rather cheap. A little bit of trivia here, on later releases of this film, especially when it came to Blu-ray, this scene has actually been touched up with some modern CGI filmmaking, and while it doesn't fix all of the problems, at least it can cover up some of the cinematic sins that we find ourselves viewing in the standard version of the film. Now, much like Dan, I too have had the same thoughts while watching this film about what exactly goes on with Peggy and the butler. They're hiding elsewhere in the house, but it's made to be pointed out that you have to be protected by the Angel of Death. You're safe in the circle. You're safe from evil due to the fact that the Duke has put enchantments around them, protect them, and he's speaking that exorcism verbiage that keeps the foursome spared from being killed outright. And yet, Peggy and the butler are just hanging out in another room, listening to all this craziness happen down the hall. Hey, don't you hear your parents screaming from downstairs? Or wonder what all those crazy horse noises are going on? It's just madness. True, true madness. So, all that said, Dan's reaction is actually something that I expected, and as an insanely reasonable person, I very much appreciate his ability to lay out what he enjoyed here and what didn't work for him as a viewer. Which again will lead me to say that if you like this level of well-thought-out commentary on things like this, or a host of other topics, please do yourself a favor. Go check out Assorted Goods Podcast, support our friends, and learn a thing or two along the way. As always, thank you, Dan. That was great. So I'm sure you're asking out there right now, Chris, how was this film received? Well, honestly, it was sort of a mixed bag. From UK critics, it was received quite well. This actually would go on to be considered by many to be a return to form for Hammer. The opportunity to see great changes both from Fisher and Lee, and both of them were praised for their work on the film. The publication Films and Filming published that Hammer has returned to its original standard, for here is a film where time, money, and a serious effort has been spent in trying to produce a good piece of thrilling entertainment, a chilling and frightening film which is vastly entertaining. London's Daily Express stated that Christopher Lee gets a hard-earned promotion for bravery above and beyond the call of duty in wrestling with the interminable number of second-rate horror films before he moves up to begin a mere count, Dracula that is, to be a rarefied heights of dukedom, with the manner and the period faithfully reproduced together with some magnificent dialogue. My favorite review, at least of the day, comes from the Daily Cinema, whose reviewer at the time heralded it as a gripping excitement sustained at a fever pitch, except for moments of what I can suspect to be intentional banality, designed to promote a therapeutic giggle, because this film contains all the eerie logic of the original novel's nonsense, question mark? Of course, but it's thrilling and oddly comforting nonsense. At least, I hope it's nonsense. Now, viewers in the U.S. were a little cagier with their assessment. New York Times reviewer Howard Thompson, back in the day, found it entertaining enough, but he also poked some interesting holes in the film's logic, noting that this occult is more of a British cup of tea, as evident from the persistent trickle of these modest melodramas, some of which have hit the jackpot. A steely aristocrat played by a suave dignity with Christopher Lee tries to outwit evil ones on their own terms and have some friends and relatives. One question, though. When the evil ones come to attack the innocents, who are forced to crouch in a protective chalk circle, where on earth were the child and the butler? See, Dan, great minds, great minds! He concludes, with all things considered, The Devil's Bride does hold together, and superstitious moviegoers could do a lot worse. Well, unfortunately, while this was deemed to be a solid film to be experienced amongst the UK filmgoers and critics, American audiences did not show up to take part in this heroic role that Christopher Lee played. And the film would go on to not even break even stateside, which created a financial loss for distributor 20th Century Fox. Had Hammer taken a greater risk and actually put some of the violence and gore that existed in Wheatley's original novel into this film, it's quite possible that this picture would be remembered for being both ahead of its time and groundbreaking. And yeah, it probably would have ruffled the feathers of the British censors at the time, but here's the thing, everything did. Ironically, in their attempts to play it safe and keep things in the black, all while heading off other potential problems, Hammer ended up creating the opposite effect for themselves. Yeah, Fisher delivered a beautiful, competently shot bit of cinematic perfection here. You have a fantastic cast. And even though it was filmed before Rosemary's Baby, it would be Roman Polanski's horror film that would set the bar and start off a wave of occult and satanic-themed horror. And the fact that Rosemary's Baby was released before this picture was released would leave audiences feeling like The Devil Rides Out was an out-of-place relic against its more modern companion fare. Had this film been successful, Hammer had Lee under contract, they could have gone forward and made an entire series around Wheatley's Duc de Richelieu character. There were so many more stories to be told, adventures to be had. Just like the Quatermass character, they could have gotten some great stuff out of it. Indeed, Hammer fans were hopeful that this would create a new golden age, would kick off new franchises, set the studio on a better path, and get them away from those tired old monsters. But instead, the wave had finally broke. And in their efforts to be classy, Hammer had found itself lost in the shuffle. The failure of The Devil's Bride stateside caused Fox to end its contract with Hammer as a distributing partner, causing them to lose even further funding, and instead of going on to try to keep innovating and release edgier pictures, Hammer would double down. Once again, Lee found himself back in black, donning a cape and sporting some fangs, in Dracula Has Risen from the Grave the following year. Time, though, has still been quite kind to The Devil Rides Out. From a certain standpoint, probably better than the film initially deserves. Yet, it still almost always tops top 10 lists when putting out films that were produced by Hammer. It's most assuredly the pinnacle when it comes to collaborations between Fisher and Lee. If you're to go on Rotten Tomatoes today and look the film up, it still maintains a cult status, but it does so with a 95% fresh rating from critics and a 76% fresh rating from viewers. Again, this is an example where I can tell you, it's not a film that's going to change your life. It's not going to blow your mind. But if you have the time to sit down and you want to watch some amazing actors make a really tightly placed, suspenseful story, one that is virtually blood and violence free, then I would tell you, this is a film that you shouldn't miss. Just be ready to take it in with a large grain of salt. The version of The Devil Rides Out screened here at the LSCE was the Anchor Bay 2004 Hammer Collection double feature, which pairs this film with the marvelous Lee offering Rasputin the Mad Monk. This version, at least for all intents at this point, is out of print, but that's no reason for you to worry, because in October of 2019, The Devil Rides Out was released on Blu-ray from Shout Factory, and it comes loaded with a host of extras, including some marvelous audio commentary from Christopher Lee, Sarah Lawson, and film historian Jonathan Rigby, not to mention a separate audio track from film historians Steve Haberman and Constantine Nassar, including 5 different documentary featurettes, including Satanic Shocks, Folk Horror Goes Haywire, Black Magic, The Making of The Devil Rides Out, Dennis Wheatley at Hammer, as well as The World of Hammer. Throw in a still gallery and some theatrical trailers, and what you got here is quite a bit of bang for your buck, and all of this can be yours for the low price of $22.71. Which I honestly think is a bargain for such a slew of interesting things. Now remember, folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where to buy your films. We just think it's important in this day and age that people keep purchasing physical media, so that the rights holders to these properties have a reason to keep releasing this content that we all know and love for our wonderful consumption. And at the end of the day, isn't that what you want? More of the things that you love? Besides, Christopher Lee is excellent in this, and it's an interesting look at a pivotal offering to come out of Hammer Studios from back in the day. So honestly, what are you waiting for? Get out there, get yourself a copy of The Devil Rides Out today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope to have you back here soon. I'd like to again extend a special thank you to our guest contributor, Dan Felton, for his participation in the sidecar this week. Please do yourself the favor, go listen, like, and subscribe to the marvelous The Assorted Goods podcast today. I can tell you his recent episode on the social history of maintaining lawns, it's both funny and fascinating, and well worth your time. Check that out today. Still can't get enough of my yakking? Wondering what it would be like to hear old Chris sit down with two lovely ladies and chat about some obscure cult films about perhaps a haughty warlock who lives in a storm drain? Well, this week I have the honor of being a guest on the hilarious and fun Bedknobs and Broom Flicks. I got to sit down with Linda and Jane to discuss the 1971 cult classic Simon, King of the Witches. We laugh a lot, we get a wee bit raunchy, and we cover a rather strange film. So look for that coming out later this week, and absolutely give those fine ladies a listen to in their own right. Again, please help support our friends. If you like what we're doing here, the LSC, Dachshunds and I, that is, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. Swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. Still proud to say that we've been added to Amazon Music, so if you have an account, please simply say, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on Podchaser. That's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and review if you could please, and hey, feel free to do that to any of the lists that we're a part of to give us a boost in the old rankings. The more reviews and the increased likes, that affects those marvelous algorithms and it makes us more searchable. And then we can share these films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with us, make a comment, ask a question, send us wonderful things, please email us at lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. If you'd like to be even more personable or you wish to contribute a segment in the sidecar, send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So, until next time, please take care out there, wash your hands, wear a mask, stay healthy, and remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.